how do we dream the life that we want to live? You know, how do we enter into that experience of synchronicity and knowing that we are aligned with the spirit that we want to see blossom in the world? And for me, the most direct way of entering into that is to, first of all, stop thinking, stop the incessant wheel that we run our lives on, the busyness, just even for 5 minutes, you know, and take a breath. Because when we take a breath, we are connecting, first of all, with the breath of life. I mean, we're breathing in the life force energy of this planet. We are also conspiring with others who are also breathing in and breathing out with awareness, with what Thich Nhat Hanh would say, mindfulness. And that means we're stopping the thinking, stopping the habits that keep us going on and on just for, you know, a few minutes to start. And in that stopping and in that taking that breath and maybe another breath and another one with awareness, maybe even 10, 15 minutes, just like that. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. In that moment, we return to our true source. We return to a place of being that is unconditioned by all that stuff going on. And if we can rest in that place without effort, without doing anything or thinking anything or making any lists or doing any of those things, if we can just rest right there and find a little bit of stability in that place, then we can go on. You'll be so surprised because you'll start to see things differently and you'll go, oh God, all that I was thinking was so important is really a waste of time.
Welcome to another episode of Green Planet, Blue Planet Podcast. My name is Julian. I'm here today with Cynthia Jours. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you so much for having me, Julian. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you are connected to me from New Mexico. And, you know, there's a whole story of yours we're going to get into today. You wrote a book called Summoned by the Earth. There's a lot of wisdom and a lot of really beautiful depth in that book. But I'd love to start with New Mexico. You said something to me right before we started recording about, you know, that I think the wording we found was original culture. Can you tell us how New Mexico turned out to be the place that you call home?
I grew up in California in the Bay Area, and I was seeking a place where I could put down my roots that wasn't, you know, too congested, so to speak. And I was always drawn to Santa Fe. I lived in Colorado a long time ago for a while, up in the mountains, chopped wood and carried water for a period of time, and came to Santa Fe and went, oh my goodness, you know, I love this place. It has culture, it has history, it has architecture, it has cuisine, it has so many things that are unique to this area. And when it was time to put down those roots, this was the place that called me. And having traveled the world as much as I have and been so connected to and moved by and learning from indigenous cultures, in particular, the Native American culture that's here has really sustained me. You know, it's so wonderful to live in a place where there's still ceremonial dances going on and feast days, and the relationship with the earth is being upheld in a sacred way. And you can feel that in the land and in the landscape. And, you know, so that's what I keep coming home to. Yeah.
That's beautiful. And I feel like this is a sentiment that a lot of us have these days, is this connection back to the earth and seeing who in our local field, as well as, you know, globally speaking, who are those cultures that have still upheld, as you said, those traditions? But your personal spiritual journey, I think the way I understood it, it went very much through and via Thich Nhat Hanh, and, you know, this idea of, you know, the next Buddha will take form of a Sangha. When did you meet the Plum Village? I'm sure you probably made it there.
Oh, yeah.
How did that story start?
Well, a long time ago, I met Thich Nhat Hanh in the early 1980s. And it was before, it was his second trip to the United States after he had come here in the 60s to teach and meet Martin Luther King Jr. And, you know, anyway, his whole story began way back when. And I met him in the 80s. And when I met him, especially when he spoke about the notion of engaged Buddhism, so really, you know, taking our practice into our lives and into what's meaningful to us in service to relieving suffering, you know, that made a lot of sense to me. And I organized a number of retreats for him early on before he was very famous. And they were seminal. They were just life-changing. And so I joined his Order of Interbeing in, 85. And he made me a teacher in 1994. He married me and my husband when we were youngsters in 92. And, you know, it's just been a long journey. So I'm really grateful to have had such an amazing teacher and been part of. I've lived at Plum Village off and on, not lived, but visited many, many times. And so that's a huge part of my life and my practice, as well as the Tibetan tradition, which I've also been deeply involved with.
Yeah, it's interesting because you said your roots originally are in California, right? So the teachings of the East coming west through California, and then ultimately that's how we started this conversation, finding the beauty back in those original cultures of the Americas. I think that's it's maybe not even, you know, I was born in 87, so, you know, I was not a youngster, but, like, you know, just a little bundle of joy at the time, you know. And so I think now, though, a lot of people can in some way or other relate to, especially in North America, to that part of spirituality, right? Like opening one's heart and ears and eyes to the teachings of the East, and then realizing and understanding over time that, well, those teachings have always been here and they've just gotten forgotten, right? And so how do you see modern America entering an age of wisdom again? Do you think there's a chance for that, or how do you dream that into being?
That's a hard one, isn't it? The United States is going through such a difficult transition, and I don't know, you know, talking about Thich Nhat Hanh years ago, he invited me to produce a retreat on what is the face of American Buddhism. And we invited artists of all different sorts to come together to really look deeply at what is this awakening in this culture, you know, for us. And it was beautiful to see us really claim our wisdom, you know, and our calling to awaken. And for me, where that has led over all these years is, and Thich Nhat Hanh spoke to this. He said, the next Buddha will be a Sangha, meaning the next, you know, embodiment of awakening will take the form of community and not the individual. And I think when he said that, it was so prophetic, really, because we're in a time when the earth is calling very loudly to us to wake up, to transform our ways in order to survive, you know, all that is unraveling right before our very eyes. And of course, here in America and elsewhere in the world, there's such a clinging to the old story, the old patriarchal structure, the hierarchical, greedy way of operating that has destroyed the earth. So we need a collective awakening. And this is one of the things that I'm really focused on a lot, because I don't think that in these times, the individual calling is going to serve what is needed, particularly. I think we've kind of worked our way through that one, and it's reached a kind of limit that it just is obvious. We're not getting very far in that way of operating. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm smack dab in the middle of it. I'm in Austin, Texas right now as we're speaking, and I feel like there's different cultural streams alive in pretty much the entire world. You know, my last 2 decades I spent between Germany, where I grew up originally, South America, Central America, and North America, right? So very much all the way from Brazil through Mexico into Canada, where I lived for a decade. And everywhere, what you just explained as, you know, through the U.S., it's kind of mirrored all around the world, right? We have a dominant culture that's much more destructive. And it's interesting that you mentioned the next Sangha will be, the next Buddha will be a Sangha, like a community, yeah. A group. And I think a big part of the dominant culture that is so both appealing, but also ultimately like challenging to deal with is, you know, the personality cult. That goes hand in hand with it is like everyone's trying to be someone and get somewhere, and that part of it is ultimately in the way, right? Is in the way to just form really strong and healthy communities. But then I also think everywhere I've gone, and you know, many of my friends and the people listening to this, they're actively looking for more community and understanding what does it actually mean to be in community, right? And maybe that's a good next question here is like, what does it mean to you? What does community and Sangha mean to you? What are some of those qualities that make it, you know, different than just being neighbors or different than just like rallying behind the same sports team?
Yeah, that's a great question, Julian. I've worked really hard to build a global community, actually. And around this practice of global healing that I've been carrying for the last 30 years and that the book that I've written is about. And I've been so moved because we have really a deep sense of loving connection between hundreds and even thousands of people who are coming together around this practice. And we share many practices now, you know, with how things are in the world. We do it on Zoom, but that allows people to join from all over the world. So we get to know each other through practicing together. We practice various things, mindfulness practice in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, also this global healing meditation that I'll talk about maybe in a minute. But anyway, to have a way to focus our intentions and align ourselves into something larger than ourselves, you know, at a certain time to synchronize our collective caring for, in this case, for the earth and what we love about life, you know, and the web of life and the beauty that is here, which we take refuge in Buddhist terms, you know, to take refuge in something so much larger than ourselves and to cultivate that connection through a sense of connection with each other, with community, gives us the energy to go forward and to engage in our lives in a way that makes a difference, you know, and then we feel ourselves part of something. You know, I think that the creative, the creativity that human beings have and the compassion that we also have are the true gifts of being human, right, that we can contribute, and also which connects us to the web of life. We're just a little teeny tiny part of something so much larger that Gaia represents, you know. And so to discover our connection to that is what I think is going to bring tremendous healing to ourselves as individuals who are so isolated and so despairing and so conflicted and at odds with each other, you know, trying to survive. So anyway, I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a place to begin, maybe.
It's a good start, yeah. Creativity, compassion, they're part of the human qualities, right? That's what I heard you say. And my question was about community and what are some of those felt parameters of community? Yeah. So,
I think that we,
you know, maybe.
Yeah, no, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I want to inspire in people and that we're turning towards now is, you know, what does it look like for the earth to be healed? What qualities do we want to see in the world? You know, because we have to start somewhere, right? We have to imagine what we love and care about and imagine how that would feel if we were living in the community that we want to live in the world, in the way that is connected and contributing to the web of life in a constructive way. And so I think it's time for us to engage with the question of what do we want to create in the world? How does it look? How does it feel? You know, to embody that.
Let's tap in a little bit into your journey there to unpack, like, how does it feel and how did some of those steps feel for you? Because I think, you know, this, you said it in the 90s, you were made a teacher, and, you know, this is not the 90s anymore. So it's been a little bit since you've been in that function and you've worked hard to bring people together. So I think very much so, that's why we're having you on today. You have so much to share and people have so much to learn and pick up. And so I'd love to learn from your journey here in this conversation together. You wrote a book called Summoned by the Earth, right? Becoming a Holy Vessel for Healing in Our World. And, you know, maybe we can walk through those chapters, but I wanted to start in 1990 when you undertook a pilgrimage that transformed your life. Do you want to tell us that story and kind of guide us into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. No, it was, I was already, as I said, you know, I had met Thich Nhat Hanh. I was already connected to Tibetan Buddhism as well. And I had the opportunity to go to Nepal to meet an old wise man living in the cave, a lama who was living in a remote part of Nepal. And, you know, at the time, it was just a long time ago, I really was just feeling my way, you know, my antenna were out, but I didn't really know what I was up to then. But I was walking up the path in the highest mountains in the world, and I suddenly realized, oh my God, I have the opportunity to ask a question of the old wise man in the cave. You know, how many of us ever have that chance? You know, what am I possibly going to ask him? I better make the most of this. This is quite an amazing opportunity. So then I was, you know, walking on and kind of struggling with what in the world to ask. But what came to me was what was in my heart, which is, what can we do to bring healing and protection to the earth? Because even back then, I was feeling, and I think many of us were aware, that we were doing a lot of damage to the earth. And I live in New Mexico, as we've said, and here is where the first atomic bomb was built and the second atomic bomb. Los Alamos National Laboratory is right across the Rio Grande Valley from Santa Fe, where I am. And the radioactive waste coming off of the production of nuclear weapons is affecting the web of life in ways that we don't even have a clue, you know. And they say the half-life of radioactive waste is 250,000 years, you know. So we're talking about big change. And then, of course, everything that has happened with climate change and world war, well, not world wars, but wars all over the world and pandemic and everything else that we're living with today. So that was my motivation in meeting this old llama. And I got to his cave and lived there for a couple of weeks and finally had the chance to, ask him my question. And he looked at me and he said, well, do you have anyone in your area who is practicing deeply? Because they will bring benefit to the whole area around where they live, And then he said, but you need to get these earth treasure vases and you need to put them in the ground and they will do that work. And my mind just shut down. I've told this story many times and it's in my book, but it just is exactly how it was. I thought to myself, well, great, how's a little clay pot filled with prayers and symbolic offerings going to address the kinds of things that we're dealing with in the world today? So rationally, it just was like, okay, well, I don't know what to do with this. But then the other part of me had to just accept this is what was coming to me. This was coming from a tradition that I respect and, a culture that has incredible teachings. And so I said, well, okay, where do we get some, And he told me where to go to have them made. And so long story short, we had 30 originally that came to us and began to work with. It took me a while because I was pretty overwhelmed by the assignment, where to take them, how to take them, where in the world, everywhere you turn, there's a problem, how do you decide, all of those kind of things. But eventually it was like, okay, we have to do this. This is what came. Maybe, who knows, maybe they will make a difference. And indeed, it has been the most amazing journey, 30 years of carrying these out. And I then received some time later, after almost finishing with those first 30, I received 40 more. And then we had another event with a Native American woman here who's a potter who helped us to craft another generation, third generation of earth treasure vases in the Native American style of pottery. And so now there's people stewarding these treasure vases besides me all around the world. And when we're done, we'll have, either close to or over 100 in the ground, having created a kind of global healing mandala of locations where these treasure vases have been buried in the earth, filled with all kinds of prayers. It's like they come alive. And then you just watch what happens because the practice really is about getting out of our own way, but the having this little clay pot allows people to pour their hearts into it and to get in touch with what they love and care about most and want to see healed and protected and restored in their own communities. And so then we realized that actually, you are a holy vessel. I'm a holy vessel. We each have something to offer that is going to be a part of restoring the balance and the harmony in this world.
Yeah, beautifully said. I love that story. And, it actually reminds me of, as you said, generally speaking, indigenous practices of like praying with certain, objects and then actually storing them in the ground. And, in a certain way, yeah, I understand that for many of us, me included at some stages of my life, the mental body might be like, wait, what? How does that make sense? Right? We're living in a world of like push button. You can, you have more intelligence in your pocket in your cell phone than maybe a president of any country even just 50 years ago or 30 years ago. And so the logical brain might be like, we need bigger machines to solve all this. But I think the deeper people have come into this journey, being on the journey and understanding the that there is a a deeper reality, a reality that is Gaia herself, the Earth herself, that is weaving the dream of what it means to be a planetary citizen, right? And so the indigenous cultures have stewarded that for a long time. You know, I'm reminded of the Kogi. I don't know how much you know about their journey and their story, but the Kogi have very clearly, you know, and they've been around. They've been around for a long time. Anybody who's interested in the Kogi of the Sierra Nevada in Colombia, go get some Google searches started and watch Aluna and other documentaries like that. But they've very much made it clear that we've disrupted some of the ley lines of the planet with, you know, modern machinery and harbors and all that. And the answer, I mean, this might escape the logical mind, but it's literally praying over specific gold artifacts and putting them back into the ground, right? Because the gold is basically part of the gold frequency of the planet, and that gold is not supposed to be in our bank account, but supposed to be in the ground as like a conductor of electricity and integrity. Do you have any connection to that story or to the Kogi at large? I'd love to hear your you take.
Well,
over
thank now. You. Yeah. Yes, as a matter of fact, back in 1990, when I met the old Lama in the cave. I had just seen the original film about the Kogi and read the book From the Heart of the World, The Elder Brother's Warning. And it affected me very deeply to hear their message about how the younger brothers and sisters were making a pretty big mess of our relationship to the earth. And they were coming out of their sequestered lifestyle, intentionally so sequestered lifestyle, way up high in the Sierras in Colombia, to give us this warning. And I carried that with me into that cave in Nepal, because I felt as if we had to do something, you know. And so it was sort of in that spirit also that I received these earth treasure vases. And then after, I don't remember how many years it was, but some years, maybe it was the mid-90s or a little bit later, that someone who was practicing with me was going to Colombia, and it offered to take one of the treasure vases to Colombia. And I said, well, yes, you can do it, but please try to get it to the Kogi and tell them, you know, here's this offering. And some of us are listening to this message that you have put out. And so she did. And we were connected to a young Arhuaco guy who was of the Arhuaco. There's four tribes in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, Colombia. One is the Kogi and another is the Arhuaco. And so Asdrubal carried this treasure vase up into the mountains and offered it to one of the Kogi elders, who lived with it for quite a while and eventually determined that it should be buried there. And so that was a really deep fulfillment that I felt in getting one there and making the connection to those people. And then Asdrubal, whose father is one of the Mamos in his tribe, also came back to me some years later and asked for another one. And he took it to the other side of the Sierra. It was also planted there. And so this has been a thread, you know, speaking of the golden thread, running through this practice. And in Australia, another place that I have been quite a few times, and actually we have a number of treasure vases buried in Australia, they speak about, the Aboriginal people speak about the song lines that are the kind of energetic highways, as one of my Aboriginal brothers would say, that connect places, you know. And so now, with the treasure vases having been buried in these places all over the planet, some of them are places of conflict, some of them are sacred places, and everything in between, we often focus on those energetic highways connecting the treasure vases with all the prayers. I mean, you can't imagine how much goes into each one. And they become like living beings, really, who are carrying the intentions for the healing, for the restoration, for our love, you know, into the body of Mother Earth, Mother Gaia. And there is such a sense of God, words are now failing me because it really is beyond words. It's beyond conceptual understanding how these kinds of sacred technologies work, right? It's something that people like the Kogi and other indigenous cultures, the Aboriginal cultures, and so many others we could name, have thousands of years of understanding about how to maintain balance in the world, in our relationship, our human relationship with nature, which has its own miraculous capacity to restore life and keep everything going. And so this is something that those of us who are a little bit awake to what's happening in the world need to reclaim, you know, and make our own relationship. And so to do that in whatever way we're called, but to make a relationship that is sacred, to be a vessel for healing, you know, to make offerings. This is another thing that we learn from the indigenous peoples all over the world, is the importance of giving back. You know, we receive everything from life on Earth, from Mother Earth, from Gaia, you know? And how often do we acknowledge that? How often do we give back? And we know from our own human relationships that, you know, when we celebrate each other, when we give to each other, we receive, right? And we need to remember to do that with the source of all life. You know, and not just take and take and take until the oceans are dead, until the crops don't grow, you know, till the poison has taken over and, you know, all we have left is fighting. You know, this isn't going to get us anywhere.
Yeah,
so giving back.
Very much so.
Yeah, giving back. And then you plant the seed and then you see what happens, because it's a miracle how things work, truly. And we're so out of touch with that, but we can get it back.
I'd be curious to hear a story or two about those miracles, Cynthia, that you've been able to connect to yourself, you know, because you're so out of touch. You're right. When we're in the logical mind and when we interface is mainstream, not just news. I think people are over news these days, you know, like it's already shifted, but mainstream culture, yeah. I think the dominant culture, there's an out of touchness with that culture, and it manifests in mental sickness, or at least in a feeling of, you know, only temporary happiness and bliss that you can get from a nice buzz, whatever your substance of choice is, or you can get from a sports game of like, whoa, what an emotional time, or from like more news, more this, more that, you know, more things to buy. But what they don't give any of us, you know, all of us included, is a lasting feeling of happiness, like a lasting feeling of connection. Yeah. We can only get that within ourselves, with other people, truly, and with nature, right? And I think that's a big part of the miracle, is to understand that that's the turnaround point, is when we prioritize the well-being of self and others, and we really truly care for others and truly are happy for others when they succeed, then, you know, then a lasting fulfillment can start to take place. What are some of your like actual stories, something that happened to you, you know, along that way of becoming the holy vessel and being a teacher of collective awakening, mm-hmm. that maybe there's a story that's on the top of your mind right now that you want to share?
There's two stories I could share. One is, I mean, there's so many stories, and most of them are in my book. So just read the book, but a shorter story and maybe a little tiny bit longer story. When I went to Mexico, there was a big hurricane. This was early on in this whole journey, a big hurricane on the coast of Oaxaca in Mexico. And we took a treasure vase to the coast. And, you know, we were going to bury it it's called Punta Cometa. Maybe you've heard of it. It's a place that is been a sacred place for, you know, many generations. And we went there to offer the treasure vase there after this hurricane that had just destroyed the coast. And we couldn't find a place to bury it. We went all the way out to the very tip of the point. And it was like, you couldn't dig there because it was just all rock. And I opened the backpack and pulled out the treasure vase and offered it up and rang my bell. And, you know, we said a prayer. And lo and behold, a whale breached right off the point. And then another whale. And the spray just came right over us and the treasure vase itself, you know. And I went, oh, yeah, right back there at the certain place, I remember there was a place where we could dig. So we went back thinking it was going to be hard as rock. There was a huge saguaro cactus standing there like a sentinel. And I saw this literally like a path lit up with light. And I could just see exactly where to bury that vase. We went to that spot, started to dig, thinking it was really hard. The land just opened up like this. And we put the treasure vase in there, buried it up, went away. 5 years later, I came back with my husband, partner, and we were there at sunset. We thought, let's just do a little meditation here at this place. And we sat down, settled ourselves, and all of a sudden, all these people started coming slowly, mindfully, quietly, walking out to this very point of land to observe the sunset and meditate at the time of the sunset. They had no idea that the treasure vase was buried there. And so there we were, you know, just stunned to see. And to this day, this is now what happens on Punta Cometa. People in the area, now the area has been built up quite a bit, so there's a lot more people there, but they go and they observe the sunset and they have a moment of a sacred moment, you know, to drop into that deeper place. So that was such a beautiful, just little small example. A much larger example comes from when I took a treasure vase to Africa for the first time. The place that I went to is a country called Liberia, which I don't know how many people have ever even heard of Liberia. I didn't even know where Liberia was at first. Liberia went through a really brutal civil war and is still recovering. It's very, it's a troubled place. But I went there after the war ended, and I was invited by a group called the Everyday Gandhis, doing peace work with tribal leaders and both the Christian and Muslim leaders. And I was invited to bring a treasure vase to the worst fought area of the war, which borders, so it's Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, all share a region where there was a tremendous amount of conflict. And everybody was still very, recovering, barely recovering. And I didn't know how a treasure vase would be accepted in that place, you know. And they informed me that they would have to consult the ancestors and see how, you know, if it would be accepted. And if so, where and how and all of that. And so a group of beautiful women went into, they were dancing, drumming, and, you know, entering into altered state and asking for direction. And sure enough, one of the ancestors came through and said, yes, this is a good thing and we should accept this. And so, so again, it's a long story and it's in the book, but the vase was accepted. It was buried in a village outside of this town called Voinjama. And in the process, I met a former rebel general who had been a leader in that part of Liberia and who was, pretty difficult character. He asked me to teach him how to meditate. And I thought, he's got to be kidding. You know, who, me, teach him how to meditate? And, but he wouldn't take no for an answer. And the vase was buried. He had this impulse to suggest to the elders to build what they call a peace hut in that village where the vase was buried as a place for people to come. It's a traditional structure where people come to resolve conflict and to meet and talk and share. And so our nonprofit helped build the first peace hut there. We went on to build 4 peace huts in conflict-prone regions of Liberia. He became a practitioner of mindfulness. He trained with me, but then he went to Plum Village and lived off and on for 3 years and totally transformed from, you know, this incredibly reactive, guy who used to carry a gun and command others to do terrible things, to reckoning with his past and becoming a peace builder and leading this other group, which now is called the Peace Hut Alliance for Conflict Transformation, and working with former ex-combatants, child soldiers, and also the women who are actually in Liberia responsible for stopping the war. It's a really interesting story. So, just to give you a little sense, that story still goes on. I mean, his transformation is truly remarkable. You know, so it's like if that can happen with him, anything is possible.
Right, and then talk about the leverage that only the right person in the right moment can then have upon hundreds or thousands of others, and the leverage that same person would have had if they didn't, find a way to find you in this moment. This man found you, and then you taught him the next step, and then the next step led to Plum Village, etc.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that's not everyone's step, and that's why the linear, logical mind would like to solve problems like that. That's not how it works, right? But if, and I have stories. Not like, just like quite like that, to be honest, but I have stories of miracles in my own life where I realized, wow, the amount of synchronicities that had to happen for this to become real above my head. Yeah. Like I can't even track it because it's just pure magic.
And but so that's when you know you're really on the path and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, is because those synchronicities start happening and you can never have planned it, but it's so perfect.
And when that's, if you're listening and you're like nodding your head and, yeah, me too, then keep going, right? And find more people that are on that journey, because that's the interesting thing. Once you are living and surfing the wave of synchronicity, you start meeting a lot of other people that do that as well. And once multiple people create a field, a coherent field of where that is kind of the norm, you start stacking the possibility of more synchronicity, which then literally becomes like a conduit for true magic.
Exactly.
And so that's the beauty of that journey, I think, is that it's not a linear path, and it's not a path that we need to fix or solve, which is sometimes, I think, why getting lost in the weeds of mainstream culture or, the negative impacts of our environmental, how we treat the environment and our environmental crises, I think, It's almost like getting lost in that with our attention and our focus takes away from the brilliance and the beauty we can create when we actually continue to weave the dream we're here to weave.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so it's not about being ignorant towards atrocities or negative things that are happening. But I do think, especially when we go into the political realm, there's a lot of that it seems like it's theater to entertain rather than it's actually creating both steps to solve things, but also to create anything someone on the journey of awakening should be attached to. I think the world we're dreaming into being is fundamentally going to run on different, a different kind of system, so to speak. And so nowadays in 2024, as we're having this conversation, Cynthia, I mean, it's, as I said, half an hour ago, it's not the 90s anymore. So we have technology that we can very well use to create any system we want to, as long as we're able to dream it into being, we're able to create enough momentum, if that's the blockchain, if that's, the internet, if, there's a technological capacity to literally outsmart anything that has been created so far. Now, we're not there yet, and I don't know how it's going to happen, but I'm pretty sure that that's going to play a role. And so in my eyes, it has to do with more and more people becoming those levers and stepping out of maybe the usual. Mm-hmm. You know, as we're coming to the close of this episode, I'd love to hear like a little bit more from you, like in your eyes, what are some of the most practical things someone can start doing? Mm-hmm. And what are these levers, no matter what level of awakening someone is at in their journey? You know, because it's not something that necessarily even needs to be measured. So what are some of those practical tips that you think can touch people's hearts right,
well,
here, right now?
You've mentioned dreaming a lot. How do we dream the life that we want to live? You know, how do we enter into that experience of synchronicity and knowing that we are aligned with the spirit that we want to see blossom in the world? And for me, the most direct way of entering into that is to, first of all, stop thinking, stop the incessant wheel that we run our lives on, the busyness, just even for 5 minutes, you know, and take a breath. Because when we take a breath, we are connecting, first of all, with the breath of life. I mean, we're breathing in the life force energy of this planet. We are also conspiring with others who are also breathing in and breathing out with awareness, with what Thich Nhat Hanh would say, mindfulness, you know. And that means we're stopping the thinking, stopping the habits that keep us going on and on, just for, you know, a few minutes to start. And in that stopping and in that taking that breath, and maybe another breath and another one with awareness, maybe even 10, 15 minutes, just like that. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. In that moment, we return to our true source. We return to a place of being that is unconditioned by all that stuff going on. And if we can rest in that place without effort, without doing anything or thinking anything or making any lists or doing any of those things, if we can just rest right there and find a little bit of stability in that place, then we can go on. You'll be so surprised because you'll start to see things differently and you'll go, oh God, all that I was thinking was so important is really a waste of time. And what's really calling me is whatever it is, you know, or I really need to take that next step in that direction. And then you start aligning slowly, slowly, you start aligning with that. And that's much more interesting, much more creative than whatever that other stuff was. And the more we start aligning with that clarity that comes from stopping, from connecting with this life force energy, this prana that is in and out all the time, you know, keeping us alive, you know, and then maybe go out and just, you know, touch the earth, walk for a few minutes with awareness of this incredible, miraculous life we've been given, you know, and then just open and ask, you know, what is my gift? What is my offering? You may not have the answer at first, you know, but it comes.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
You're a beautiful and brilliant testament to that last part you said. The answer does come. And then you make the next step,
yeah.
Right? And then you connect with the next person, and then you weave an invisible thread that actually, you know, takes people from being, you know, like this man in Liberia, right? Being an actor of destruction to suddenly becoming a leverage for peace and for healing. And so, Cynthia, thank you so much for the stand you are in the world, for the way you've walked over the decades, for the people you've touched, the work you've done, and for your book. Everyone listening, go get the book, Summoned by the Earth. There are a lot more stories in there, and it's fun to read, right? And it's one of those calls to action, like how and when are we summoned by the earth? Because the earth does ultimately summon all of us. That's why we're here. And that's why we're alive on planet Earth or Mother Gaia, however you want to call her. You know, we're alive right now on this earth. And there's more to do than just, you know, sit around a television and eat sandwiches. So let's go out there and do it.
This is the time. It's time. We're in it right now, this time of collective awakening. And we really need to come together. So read the book, but also, and the book is hopefully a page turner. I think it's kind of a page turner myself, but come to the meditation on the full moon too. It's a full moon meditation. We do it every month, and it's really a way to cultivate exactly what we're talking about. So you can find out about that on, it's the website is GaiaMandala.net.
I will make sure to put that in the show notes as well. For right now, thank you so much, Cynthia. Yeah. This was a pleasure to talk to you.
You too, Julian. Thanks very much for being with me. Yeah.